You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A well-meaning but clueless young short story writer named Henry Lang is the hero of Michael Daly's novel, The Best of Youth. Henry, whose wealthy parents died during a freak boating accident while he was in college, has used part of his $15 million inheritance to move to Williamsburg, Brooklyn, to fulfill his literary dreams. This is Mr. Daly's second novel. His first, A Gentleman's Guide to Graceful Living, won the Penn Hemingway Award in 2009 and the Whiting Writers Award the following year. This new book is published by Norton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Michael Daly to our show. Hello.
Thanks. It's a great pleasure.
Although it's clear you have a lot of affection for Henry, you're also poking fun at him. Isn't it almost a cliche now for young writers and artists to move to Williamsburg or one of the other trendy neighborhoods in Brooklyn like Greenpoint, Bushwick, or Bed-Stuy?
Yeah, it is, and I've had a couple interviewers sort of contact me and say, you know, I got to say, when I first was sent this, I couldn't believe someone was writing yet another novel about young people in Brooklyn. But they, I guess they liked it. But I lived in Brooklyn for 6 years and was part of no literary scene at all. So,
and now you are the Booth Tarkington Writer in Residence at Butler University in Indianapolis. Is there some kind of a culture shock when you move from Brooklyn?
Yes.
I don't know. Were you in Williamsburg?
I was in Park Slope. I was actually in
with
Chelsea
all the other older writers.
Back to the culture shock. It was quite a shock. But I had a 2-year-old boy, and it was really nice to not be panicked every month coming up with rent, and so it's a kind of a nice place to live right now.
You seem to enjoy writing about wealthy characters. Arthur Camden, the hero of A Gentleman's Guide to Graceful Living, was also born rich. Were you?
I was not. I grew up in Minneapolis till I was 8, and my dad kind of got into banking in sort of a strange way. And so what I'd say is that I was definitely raised sort of in a kind of upper middle class family, but nothing close to what a banker makes today.
But you talked about trying to come up with the rent in Park Slope. Did you have fun imagining for this book what it would be like not having to worry about money while living in New York City?
I thought about how fun it would be to have money for all 11 years that I lived in New York. So it was kind of fun to write this book just pretending that I was living here and rich, because most of the time I was pretty broke.
I guess that's why they call novel writing fiction.
Yeah.
Weren't you so short of cash while you lived here that you had to take cash advances on your credit card in order to pay the rent?
I hate to say this because I imagine my mother and father-in-law are going to be listening to this. But when I won the Whiting, every penny of that went to pay off the credit card debt that I had accumulated over the 11 years that I'd lived here.
When this novel opens, we learn that Henry has invested $30,000 to help some people he barely knows launch a literary magazine called Suckerhead. What does Henry hope to gain out of it from that investment?
Well, I think Henry simply doesn't quite understand what's going on at all, and he gets taken advantage of a lot. But I think he wants to be a part of something going on in Brooklyn, and someone offers him the opportunity of investing $30,000 in a magazine, and he jumps at it.
One critic described this novel as a timeless story of a nerd trying to fit in with the cool kids.
Yep. That's kind of how I describe it, too.
And Henry's only real friend during the early years, or the early days anyway, in Brooklyn is Abby, who's a beautiful young musician, also happens to be his fourth cousin. It's pretty clear that Henry would be attracted to Abby, but since she seems to be a lot more sophisticated than he is, why does Abby pay any attention to Henry?
Well, I think that, first of all, they've got some kind of connection that she can't really avoid, namely that they're related. But Henry is a really decent human being, and I think that hopefully that comes through in the book, and I think it comes through with Abby, especially since she's kind of in the music business in New York. I think she's probably not hanging out with many people like that.
But he develops a huge crush on her.
He does. He loses it at the end because he kind of has to. But yes, he's desperately in love with her. But he falls in love with lots of people.
But he also checks with in the internet to make sure that they are distant enough cousins so that this would not be incest.
And presents the research to Abby, but it's not convincing.
Although Abby makes it clear she thinks of Henry only as a friend, she invites him to spend several weekends with her at her aunt's farm in Vermont. One of the funniest scenes in the novel takes place during one of those weekends. You want to tell us about it?
He's up there alone and is going to meet her on Christmas Day. And Henry, it's a freezing. There's a terrible storm and all the electricity goes out. And Henry tries to keep this flock of priceless Libyan goats owned by this hedge fund, the wife of a hedge fund manager. And he puts a generator in their barn, and it does keep them warm, but the carbon monoxide kills them all. And
making the other people in the area very happy.
Yeah.
They hate those guys.
Yes, exactly.
My guest is Michael Daly, Dahlie. His latest novel is The Best of Youth. Most of the stories that Henry writes are about old people. Why old people?
I don't know. I think that maybe was stolen a little bit from thinking about my first book, which was written not about an old person, but about a 60-year-old living on the Upper East Side. And for some reason, people found this to be completely bizarre that a 30-year-old's first novel would be about a 60-year-old. So it kind of came up in the book.
Are you surprised by the fact that people are surprised by that? I mean, you could have written a book about a serial killer. Nobody would have assumed that you were a serial killer. You could have written a book from the viewpoint of a woman, and nobody would remark on that anymore.
Well, I think one of the interesting – I have a sister who's 12 years younger than me, I was always – flat broke, but then I'd get a check from one of my various freelance gigs, and I had leased an apartment in Paris, and my dad died kind of shortly after that, and my sister was just getting out of college. She had no intention of coming to New York, and I was 34, she was 22, and we spent a lot of time together in Williamsburg and Greenpoint. And I was kind of adopted by all her friends, but still kind of as that strange 30-year-old guy. So I think the thing is that I think some people expect or think of this book as me writing a lot about my life in Brooklyn. But I really wrote this book, too, as an observer, as someone who's part, watching this culture, but not really part of it.
On your website, you admit that you've written young adult novels under pseudonyms that have received starred reviews in Publishers Weekly, Booklist, and Kirkus, and they've even appeared in the Washington Post top 10 list of books for young people. Why not under your own name?
I was pretty sure, and I think this is still the case, that it's a hard transition to make from writing for children to writing for adults, and you're always reviewed if you go in that direction as sort of a guy who writes children books taking a shot at the so-called real thing.
Haven't you also written other things and used pseudonyms? Not just
I've written quite a bit under pseudonyms for grown-ups, mostly in literary journals and I'm not sure I have a good reason. It's a set of complicated reasons. I guess the one that I use most is that I didn't want my mother to know that I wrote about sex and drugs. So pseudonym was the easiest way out.
Well, we all know Joyce Carol Oates' pseudonyms, but do we know yours yet?
I don't know if I've broadcast them. The Michael Simmons is my sort of children's book or books for young readers pseudonym, and Luther Magnuson. Just basically, I one of the things about the Luther Magnuson stories is I tend to write about failed, disgraced men, and I wanted to write about the most fantastic man that I could think of, and that was kind of the most fantastic name that I could come up with.
Well, in this book, Henry has some success selling his stories, generally well received, but his big break comes when Abby introduces him to a literary agent at a party who hires him to be a ghostwriter. Have you ever done any ghostwriting?
I have quite a bit, but on a very kind of low-grade scale, mostly. Again, I was a hack writer for years in New York, and most of my ghostwriting gigs were other authors calling me at the last minute, way behind deadline, asking me if I could write something for them. So that was, it wasn't quite as glorious involved as Henry's job is.
Do you think that all that hack writing has had has helped you when you write the books that you really care about?
Absolutely. I mean, just having to write every day helps. I don't ever suffer from writer's block. I think mostly because I had so much experience just having to turn things in, because if I didn't, I'd starve.
Well, I've heard that when Joseph Conrad hit a wall and couldn't write, he'd call up Ford Madox Ford, who also didn't have writer's block, and Ford Madox Ford would write the chapter for him and get him to the next point.
Yeah, I need someone like that myself.
Well, I'm looking through Conrad trying to spot any Ford Madox Ford. So who does Henry wind up writing for?
Well, Jonathan Kipling, the Hollywood star, sometimes violent, drug addicted, quite. He's got his charms, but he turns out to be a pretty bad guy.
But the book obviously is not meant to reveal all of those things.
The young adult novel that he writes. No, the book is supposed to be a young adult novel that presents Jonathan Kipling as this wonderful altruistic man who's also a literary genius as well.
You've said that for you, writing is like dreaming. Is that why it comes so easily?
Yeah.
You also say it's quite calming. Most people don't feel that.
Yeah, I do write a lot, and I guess that when I say it's like dreaming, I kind of what I mean is to sort of counter the sort of idea that writing fiction is somehow a kind of act of truth telling, and writing what you know and getting to the truth and writing one true sentence. And for me, it's I don't want to say it's smoke and mirrors because that sounds too pejorative, but it really is an act of imagination, and even when you're writing about something as directly as you possibly can, it comes from the imagination and from a dream, I think.
And does the humor come just organically as a matter of course?
It does. I'm not sure that I know much about joke writing. I don't spend a lot of time kind of actually hammering those out. It just kind of comes as the story flows.
Writers have often told me that they felt a lot of pressure writing their second novel after their first one had been a success. Well, your first novel, as I said earlier, won the Penn Hemingway Award and the Whiting, and received a glowing review from Janet Maslin in the New York Times. So did you feel that pressure when you're writing this book?
You know, those awards came. The Penn Hemingway came a full year after my book was released, or not a full, I guess 11 months. And I was well into this book when it arrived. And so I was still kind of fairly obscure and just kind of sitting in my dark room in Park Slope doing my work and not thinking much about it. So it worked out well.
But I suspect it's the reason that you were named the Booth Tarkington Writer in Residence at Butler.
Yeah, I think that was a big reason I got that job as well.
And this book is terrific too. So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It's The Best of Youth, Michael Daly's new novel, Dahlie, published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.